I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. One of the more engaging and important books of the year is Views of the Salish Sea, 150 Years of Change Around the Strait of Georgia. Its author, Howard MacDonald Stewart, joins me now to talk about this book. It's a terrific-looking book, but it's also a substantive look at the uniqueness of the waters off British Columbia's shoreline. Unlike other books on the Salish Sea, Dr. Stewart looks at the Strait's evolution over the last century and a half and looks at how it and the humans who inhabit close by are interconnected. The book also highlights the relationship that people have had with it over time, such as the indigenous, travelers, engineers, and entrepreneurs. The view of conservationists and environmentalists is also presented. That's important as resources are extracted from and or passed through these waters, signaling our own consumption and the region's future itself. And while the book looks to the past, it's very much rooted in how our behavior today will signal our future. It's such a unique and diverse ecosystem that we often overlook how remarkable it is in the rush to drain its resources. Howard MacDonald Stewart has worked with the United Nations, as well as various levels of government in Canada, international agencies, and NGOs. He completed his PhD in geography at the University of British Columbia in 2014, from which this book grew out of his thesis. He has contributed to numerous popular and academic publications, BC Studies and the Ormsby Review for two. This book is from Harbor Publishing. Please welcome to the Planta Online program on Denman Island today, Howard Stewart. Dr. Stewart, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
As I was telling you just before we started, just what a beautiful book this is. But beyond that, what an important book it is. And I guess that's this sea, the Strait of Georgia, it's something that we have taken for granted a lot. And not just those of us that live here, but I mean even tourists and the sort, but especially us that live here, and not to mention, say, the policymakers, the politicians.
Yeah, I agree with you. It's always there, and I think it has much more of an influence upon us and us upon it than we tend to recognize.
Yeah, this book is quite substantive, and it's one that people ought to read. I'm glad to see that it's appeared on various bestseller lists already.
So am I, of course.
Yeah.
But I think it's important for people to have a far better idea of, you know, what their backyard, this great, beautiful sea that we all live around, how it's evolved so rapidly in the last 150 years.
Yeah.
The message is the change that's taken place so rapidly and usually sort of because of us, but outside our control.
Right.
So continues to change. Continue to change rapidly in the future. We need to have a little more control over that, I think.
Yeah, well, we'll talk about that in just a sec. But how did this book come about? I understand it came out of your thesis. Is that right?
It did. I mean, one way of defining it is as an environmental history, although I did it as a geographer. A lot of environmental historians are geographers. Partly because I'd spent a lifetime wandering around sticking my nose in other people's business related to, you know, environmental and resource management issues.
Yeah.
Kind of wanted to focus on my own backyard that I didn't think I knew enough about and that I wanted to describe in a book like this. I always hoped it would be a book that was much more kind of for the broad readership rather than an academic tome, and that's what it's turned out to be with much help from Harbor Publishing.
Yeah, you know, despite our proximity to the Strait, I mean, two-thirds of British Columbians live close to it.
Yes.
We don't seem to know about it. Does that frustrate you, especially since it's so important?
I wouldn't say it frustrates me so much as I think that so many people, if you scratch them, they will tell you how deeply attached they are to it, how fond they are of it. But it's more kind of an anomaly that we know so little about it for a variety of reasons. You know, the book that kind of looks like a coffee table book hopefully will draw people in to read a lot of the details that are more kind of substantive than you find in a coffee table book.
The first time I went to the East Coast to New York State about 2 years ago, you know, I loved it because this is the first time I've been on that side of the world.
Yeah.
And so I took a train up the Hudson, and I thought, you know, this is pretty nice. But then, you know, it's not as beautiful as this place is, and it made me homesick for the first time in those, you know, few days that I was over there.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the Hudson is one of those places like the Chesapeake Bay and lots of other places around North America that have evoked this kind of response. You know, there's good environmental histories about the Hudson River and so on, and certainly the deepening crisis on places like the Hudson River, the Hudson Estuary there around New York and the Chesapeake Basin kind of also got the initial wave of concern about the Strait of Georgia back here in the sort of 1970s especially. Mm. There was a lot more concern then about environmental degradation on the Strait than we usually see today.
Yeah, it's also unique in terms of its biology. I mean, the number of species.
Indeed.
You know, the number of species alone. I mean, you know, you could have a book just about
that. I got to say, there are better books if you want to really get into the fish and all the vertebrates and invertebrates and so on around the Strait. There's good books on that. My book talks about that on the way by, but it doesn't really focus on that.
Yeah. Now, in terms of as an economic resource, has this sea, has this Strait of Georgia, has it always been exploited as it has?
No. I mean, there's a huge huge dividing line. I start the history at the beginning of colonization, at the beginning of this deliberate resettlement process that was set in motion by the imperial government in London in 1849. That was a huge break with the past in the sense that this had been a heavily populated indigenous space for millennia. The people who had lived around it had gone through a tremendously difficult couple of generations, faced with all sorts of exotic diseases. That period that went from roughly the 1780s to the 1860s saw just a vast die-off. 90-95% of indigenous people died, and then you have a whole new era that we tend to think of as, you know, modern British Columbian history. I didn't feel placed to discuss that pre-colonial history very well, although I do summarize it in some detail in that chapter on dispossession around the Strait, but I mostly focused on what's happened since the beginning of colonization by Eurasian populations.
And since
then, there's a huge change in the way we do everything.
Right. Yeah.
With that.
And since then, how would you characterize the relationship between, say, the indigenous, and those that colonized?
I don't think we have enough time. And again, you know, other people are better at this. I've drawn heavily in every one of these five different histories that make up the book. I've drawn heavily on the best work that's been done over the last couple of decades. So people like Cole Harris or Doug Harris or even Diane Newell on the fishery side of the dispossession are much more authoritative experts than me. But what happened essentially is that these people were put aside. A little tiny bit of land was set aside for them. They were extremely valuable well into the colonial period, well into the 20th century as industrial proletariat, you know, so those industries, forestry, fisheries, mining, that were so important for the colonial and British Columbian economy were heavily dependent on indigenous labor, but they didn't really see, the colonial governments have not seen any other role for indigenous people, really, so indigenous people have had to resist tenaciously and have resisted tenaciously, and you know, only just now in the last couple of decades with a few landmark decisions in the federal court have come back and started to really reclaim this vast amount of land and resources that was taken away from them. You know, the colonial government in British Columbia was particularly inept. One reason people don't really connect the dots, but one reason why the whole province and most of the Strait of Georgia is so up against it when it comes to the indigenous people's claims is that the colonial process of dispossession was essentially illegal by British law.
Yeah.
And you can't hide that forever. I mean, they spent many decades kind of avoiding having to face with that. But once the landmark decisions in the 1980s came through, the writing's been on the wall. The province in particular has really no legal case to stand on, and it knows it. It will go a long ways out of its way to avoid going to court for that reason.
Yeah, and because you talk at the end of the book I bring that up because you talk at the end of the book about the future. And, well, I guess the book is rooted in the future, isn't it? I mean,
it is, more than most histories are supposed to be.
Yeah, and so I'm curious to know what you think as to the voice of the indigenous. And yes, it's emerging. As to its influence into the future, I mean, do you think that's guaranteed at all?
Well, again, with the caveat that I'm not the expert. You know, I put this all together in the context of the Strait, but when I look at it, I think it's important to recognize that all our indigenous communities around the Strait are as heterogeneous in terms of opinion. There's lots of different factions within those different communities, so I will not generalize about their role. I will say that they are in a position to play an extremely, and are have in many cases played an extremely constructive role in terms of turning the corner, particularly in the way we manage the Strait and the resources around the Strait. But there's all sorts of other issues as well. They're desperately in need of their own economic resources to make up for 150 bad years. So there's certainly other, you know, short-term economic alternatives that interest indigenous communities and their partners that I don't necessarily see as particularly promising. So it's really a mixed bag. But one thing that's certain is that, and everybody in the provincial government in particular and federal government will tell you, when things aren't really going to happen without indigenous people in the way that we've completely marginalized them for the first several generations after colonization, they're going to have to be much more central in subsequent generations, as they should have been from the beginning, of course.
The interconnectedness of the evolution of the sea and how we live, that's been there from the beginning, hasn't it? I mean, it really does shape how we and where we choose to live.
Yeah, I mean, that's one thing that, you know, one of those things that there's a strand going back to pre-colonial times. The sea is such an important presence in our lives, as it was in the lives of the indigenous cultures that preceded us. Certainly it has been. If you look at what's happened since colonization, we tend to not think of it that way, but life is different here in quite a few ways from other parts of Canada and North America because of the sea. You know, the way we move around, the kind of resource exploitation we do, the way we do our resource exploitation, the way we take our recreation, you know, the recreation resources available to us, the way we dispose of our waste is quite unique compared to many places, and it's all related to this big, beautiful, not particularly well-managed sea that we all live beside.
Speaking of not well managed, I guess it's a good place to bring up the ferry system, because
yes.
Because this is not only an important waterway. I mean, well, it is an important waterway because it's how a lot of people, especially in parts where you live, I mean, how you get around, right?
Yeah. Again, you know, things keep changing, so let's see what's going to happen over the next several years, but roughly 20% of the population of the province is not just those of us who live on small islands. There's also the, 800,000 people who live on the big island, and all those people going up the coast are very ferry dependent. The system expanded in leaps and bounds after the Second World War with the expansion of the highway system and so on. And at the time when a free enterprise government was setting it up as a provincial utility, it was recognized that ferries were an essential extension of our transportation system. It's only been in the last 15 years or so that this whole idea has come about of it being some kind of privileged service. I get most irritated by hearing people from northern BC, for example, complain that people who live on islands should have to, pay for living on islands.
Right.
Everywhere in BC has to pay for where we live. If you live in an isolated community anywhere across the province, you know, the province pays a great deal of money for your highway system.
Right.
We look upon it as part of the highway system, but it hasn't been looked upon that way recently, and prices of the ferries have gone up astronomically as the service has gone down, and it's had a great deal of economic impact on a number of islands. Denman's one of the few where the population has actually grown significantly in the last 10 years.
So why do you think it is that well, not only our fellow British Columbians elsewhere don't view it as a necessity, but by extension, the politicians, the policymakers in Victoria, why don't they see it?
Well, I think that I wouldn't be prepared to say that about the current government. You know,
I see.
Partly
yeah.
It's also the geopolitics of the province. The previous government had virtually no seats in these ferry dependent ridings, and the opposite is the case now. The government and its partner, the Greens, have almost, you know, a huge amount of their seats are in ferry dependent communities. So we're expecting a different attitude. But it was certainly part of that political polarization. If you don't get any seats, if you don't count on the political support from a region, then it's an easy place to cut budgets.
Yeah.
Particularly this whole process of turning the ferry corporation into some odd hybrid, where they're a private company that pays its executives vast amounts of money, and yet is also getting support from the public purse when it needs it. It's become a kind of a monster. Hopefully they'll get it sorted out, but it'll be a very political process again.
And again, it changes the way that people live their lives. I mean, they have to do things at a certain hour.
Yeah.
Because they can't get around.
It is that people live in these places, establish themselves in these places with an understanding that they had a service that was an extension of the highway service, and then suddenly it became a luxury. The province felt it could no longer cover and left it up to this new company, you know, to... It was almost a little bit like asset stripping, you know, that we see in the corporate world. Basically taking the best that they could get out of it and leaving everybody else to get on the best they could.
Yeah.
A lot of the tourists, this journalist, I think his name is Stephen Hume, has written about the huge economic damage that it's done to some of the southern islands in particular.
Yeah. Now, the renaming of the Georgia Strait to the Salish Sea, I mean, that's something that's come about the last 20 years or so, is that right?
Yeah, as far as I know, it's actually a kind of a cross-border thing. So it's not just the Strait of Georgia, it's also the Juan de Fuca Strait
right.
and Puget Sound. All three together constitute the Salish Sea. And it's a great idea.
Uh-huh.
You know, the province and Washington agreed on it and progressively introduced the nomenclature into their maps, but I try to clarify that if we want to use that name for the Strait of Georgia, we should call it the North Salish Sea, because it's
right.
The two things aren't synonymous. The Salish Sea and the Strait of Georgia are not the same thing. The Strait of Georgia is just one of three lobes.
Mm-hmm.
So you should talk about the South Salish Sea and the Puget Sound and the West Salish Sea, the Strait of Juan de Fuca. And then we can, if we use those names systematically, we can dispense with the old names if we want to.
Right. Yeah, this fear of loss. I mean that's at the heart of rooting this book with a view to the future. That's always been there. I mean, whenever you see something beautiful or something that's important, you're always afraid that it'll be gone. It just seems at this point in these times that we live in, there's certainly uncertain. That it's as urgent as it is. I mean, is that your sense?
I think so. I mean, I tried to play both sides, and you know, from an intellectual point of view, you could criticize the book because I identify that fear of loss as something that runs through all the stories. So it's not just us who fear losing this treasure of a strait as essentially a space where we can enjoy life, but it's also the people who have depended on it so tremendously as a waste dump. I've also been, if you think about the pulp mills, maybe it's kind of historical oddity for most people, but the pulp mills spent a very long time tenaciously defending their right to dump this cocktail of stuff into the strait that they did, even decades after Jacques Cousteau said, you know, the whole thing is going to be dead if you don't stop doing this. They managed to continue for another 20 years. Similarly, people who use the strait as their fisheries resource or who used all the watersheds around it as basically their private forest and did a huge amount of damage to the salmon fishery, in particular, in the process, they very tenaciously defended their right to do so and were constantly, you know, worried about having to face the music, basically lose their right to do what they were doing. So it's not just been us who see it as this kind of treasure. Everybody else who uses it also fears losing their right to do so. And similarly, transportation people, you know, from the word go, Vancouver, this dominant city on the strait, exists because the federal government recognized it as a place where it could have its outlet to the Pacific and to Asian markets. That's never changed. And they have always also been very worried about losing their access to the sea. Mm-hmm. You see early archives around Vancouver, they're already the harbor authorities are warning, you know, we've got to be really careful to protect our harbor facilities from other things. And, of course, that's playing out now. This whole dispute over Kinder Morgan is the rest of the country seeing it as its traditional right to use our water in ways that they see fit for their own transportation. That's not new.
So
we're all fearing loss of different kinds, and it's kind of competing fears of loss.
So the imperative, though, especially the political imperative, does the public understand that, and by extension, do policymakers, do politicians, do they do well in the public interest, do you think?
Could you sort of rephrase that? I'm not quite sure if I understand the question.
Sure. Yeah, I guess if the public feels that way, if the public's there, the politicians caught up to us, the policymakers especially?
Yeah, I think that, again, to be honest, I would like people to read the book and feel more inspired to speak out if they're worried about it. I think there is a great kind of latent fear of loss of the Strait as this jewel that it is, but I don't think that it's very well organized. There's this Georgia Strait Alliance and other people who work very hard and do great work to try to protect it, but they're faced with very powerful interest when you look at this pipeline, you know, bringing a pipeline out to Tidewater at Burnaby as an example, other projects around the street in various places. The proponents of those projects that represent different types of threats to the Strait are able to bring a huge amount of very concentrated power to, you know, influence to play. It's really quite striking what kind of projects can be put on the table despite the damage that they'll do. Yeah. At one point, people wanted to transform all of Gambier Island into a giant copper molybdenum mine, and it was totally legal from the point of view of the province's archaic mining laws. Yeah. And that only was defeated because it was, you know, just too outrageous for some place like Howe Sound. But similar projects are always kind of creeping up around the street, and they bring to bear very powerful economic interests.
You know, in the news this past week, aquaculture and fish farming, has come up. You know, I was a great devotee of Ralph Mayer, and when he died recently, remembered, you know, the campaigning that he did against that.
Yeah.
Do you think? First of all, there has been an impact on the waters, hasn't there?
There certainly has. I mean, it's kind of what, for most people, when they think of aquaculture, they think of salmon culture, and that kind of moved a little bit beyond the pale in the sense that most of the salmon farms only reach the strait at the very far northern extremities up in the Discovery Islands, Quadra and so on. But what we see, what we're much more concerned about, is the rapid expansion of shellfish aquaculture and a whole different set of issues. But same but different. You know, it's not that people are opposed to shellfish aquaculture in principle. It's the same as the salmon culture. It's how it's being done and the fact that the industries basically have been taken over. It's regulatory capture, as they call it. Basically, the industry controls the regulatory bodies rather than the other way around and are permitted to do all sorts of things which really are not in our interests. I won't go into detail unless you want to about the shellfish industry, but it's doing all sorts of outrageous things around us these days with impunity from neither DFO nor the provincial authority, the FLNRO, really do anything. They basically tell us it's going to have to be some kind of serious catastrophe before they really kind of have any sort of political motive to change things.
So taking that and that view of say, you know, one level of government, are you then without hope as to our future and how?
No, but there's a great deal to do. No, I'm not without hope. I think that everybody, every generation has to have their own challenges. Certainly, there's lots here. If I had to bet on things happening within a certain time frame, that'd be a tougher question. But I'm not without hope so much as just worried about how bad things will have to get before the backlash causes things to get better. And the real problem is this regulatory capture, this whole propensity that we have had now for decades to allow the industries to regulate themselves, which they don't do very well, or they certainly don't do in the interest of the public. They do it in the interest of their industry. I mean, same as you see the hydrocarbons industry in Alberta. It's shocking what they get away with, but basically they establish their own regulatory framework and then lead the government by the nose. When we talk about aquaculture here, whether it's salmon or shellfish, it's essentially the same phenomenon. Yeah. And it's not, the government people are not all complicit so much as they're unable. Their capacity to actually properly regulate and manage these industries has been ground down to almost nothing.
Yeah. But what we're able to do is read this book and you know, get active ourselves. This book is such a marvelous place to start because you do realize just how important this sea is and just how important, well, getting up and doing something is important not only for ourselves but for future generations. You've done a marvelous service with this book, Howard.
Well, I'm very happy to hear that. Thank you. That's made my day.
Yeah. Well, you know, as I said, it's an important book to read, but it's a beautiful one at that. Just very necessary. So congratulations on it. I just realized that I could talk to you all day about this. But I appreciate your time today, and I do hope that a lot of people pick this up. It's a great gift too, this time of year.
Yeah, that's what Harbor has done, a very good job of making it look cosmetically pleasing. You know, I gathered up all the archival pictures, but they've made it really, really look wonderful to look at. Yeah. And I've had actually quite a lot of, I talk a little bit up and down the street about the book, and a lot of people are having similar reactions to what you, which is very gratifying. Of course, people really, once they get thinking about it, a lot of people feel very strongly about it.
Yeah. Well, thanks for your time today, Howard.
Thank you.
The book is called Views of the Salish Sea, 150 Years of Change Around the Strait of Georgia. Harbor Publishing is its publisher, Howard MacDonald Stewart. Its author joined me on the line from Denman Island in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.